iPhones upon this little earth, multiplying, dying, and returning to rebirth. All the little children growing up in space, adding less more stories to the history of this race. Here on Earth, here on Earth.
Hello and welcome to Unfrozen, episode 121, Dwelling on Earth. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Our guest today is Stefan Ahl. He is the author of Dwelling on Earth, the past and future of the places we call home. Stefan, welcome.
Thanks again, and great to join both of you for the second time on your amazing show.
Well, thanks a lot. So you've taken on a big chunk of history here, pretty much the entire civilization of humankind. No big deal. I am sure that there was a prime motive behind this that we can unpack pretty easily. But I guess I want to start with a question of, when you set out to do this, was there a big civilizational or urbanization theory that you wanted to debunk or put to rest? Like, civilization started like this, and you wanted to disprove it.
Well, there's the narrative that cities are founded by big rulers in palaces and in temples. And that's why we always look at monuments and temples, and monumental architecture. And that the house itself is kind of this side story, the scenery around which civilization occurs. And what I found as I went back to the very origins is that it's actually very different. It's actually the other way around. That the house came first, and civilization kind of emerged from that. As a matter of fact, the first temples were actually deliberately shaped like a house in a lot of societies. And it just strikes me that, you know, we spend so much time thinking about monuments, but in reality, it's the humble house that was so important. You know, a lot of civilizations knew this. If you go to ancient Greece, for instance, the word oikonomia means management of the household. So the word economy is derived from the house. The house was up until then kind of the chief unit of the economy. It was kind of a mini factory and contributing to the economy. So that's really striking, and that's one of those things that we forget. And even today, the house is more relevant than ever. The bulk of the built volume we build is residential architecture. We spend 90% in North America of our lives indoors, and the vast majority of that is inside the house. And that also brought me to why I started this book. It kind of started during COVID, when we're spending a lot of time at the home, and I think for many of us, this caused some reflection on how we should live. So the bigger argument of the book is, the home is not just where we live; it's also how we live, and it has a lot of impact on so many things, from the economy to our lifestyle, to our health, our social relations. And so on. So I'm trying to show all of that in this book.
Interesting. I mean, one of the observations that was, I thought, most insightful was, again, you've alluded to this already, the idea that it seems like the design and the conception of the home directed the development of other types of buildings, such as temples. But at some point, it seems like somewhere between Mesopotamia and Rome in history, there seemed to be a change in relationship between at least religious buildings and other symbols of institutional power and domestic dwellings. So you have an observation from Seneca, who says something like, the wealthy live in temple-like buildings, but we can tell that they were built by slavery. Let's unpack that a little bit. What happened?
Yeah, no, that's pretty interesting, right? So we start with the home, and as homes start to cluster together, there's this kind of emergence or this complexity that emerges. And that kind of complexity then leads to some rulers and differentiation. So the kind of the first settlements, you know, most homes were equal in size. But then as the settlements, as we get better at agriculture and we are able to reproduce more and feed more mouths, those settlements get bigger. You start to see differentiation in those homes. And then from that, it's the emergence of larger homes that become the temple. So that kind of becomes this enlarged version of a house in Mesopotamia that's very obvious. So if you look at the first temples, they have exactly the same organization and floor plan as a house. It just built a little bit bigger, and they may have some variation in how they built it. You know, a couple thousands year later in Rome, you see the precise opposite. So you see how homes start to mirror the temples. Because it was a little bit of social aspiration. So for the first time, you see how, you know, individual residents, they start to mimic kind of church or palace architecture by cladding their homes with marble, sometimes faux marble. Yeah, not everybody liked that, like Seneca, who was complaining about that, but he himself also... had several private villas, and himself was also doing that. But it's something we still do today, right? So a lot of our homes today, we still value marble as kind of a luxury material. And I think some of that we got from the ancient Romans.
And of course, you know, we have lots of people who shall remain unnamed, but are currently in power who seem to think that golden marble is still a pretty important thing to project in terms of both domestic and institutional architecture. So this is interesting. Another thing that I thought was really striking about this, well, actually, let's dwell on this topic of origins and for one more round here. How do you sort of square this idea of the home sort of being the foundry of the city with something like, I don't know if you're familiar with forensic architecture. They did a project called the Nebelivka hypothesis, which took an archaeological dig in Ukraine and kind of established that it was centerless and there was no kind of governing institution. It kind of came off as a little bit of a sort of a pre-religious, if not anti-religious, screed, but it was an interesting perspective. Did you look into something like that? And how does it square with your own research?
Yeah, absolutely. So I focus on Mesopotamia. The second chapter is on Mesopotamia. First, it's kind of in the Levant, where kind of the first settlements emerge. But then the city emerges in Mesopotamia. And there's a similar phenomenon to what they are describing happens in Ukraine. And it's a very vast settlement. You know, sizable, the size of a small town, but there's no signs of monumental architecture. And that phenomenon, it doesn't really allow us to classify it as a city, right? What is a city? It has many requirements, but one of them is you need monumental architecture. So why are they important? Because since we found them across cultures, so in Ukraine, but also in Mesopotamia, the hypothesis is now that most likely this was kind of not quite a city, but it was a proto-city. It may have ultimately led to a city, but it was essentially a collection of households that all lived together, and there were some benefits in living together. So in the case of Mesopotamia, there was this volcanic glass, obsidian, that they imported from far and wide, and they started to manufacture blades with this volcanic glass. So there was kind of a center that was emerging, but it was all based on kind of individual households that wanted to benefit from this trade and craftsmanship. And it wasn't kind of this, most likely, it wasn't like this overall ruler that organized this. So that kind of supports that theory that cities have likely emerged from the bottom up, from the household.
Interesting. So kind of a case of organic growth in terms of the tools that were used for agriculture, and but there were also benefits in terms of people living in close proximity, you know, being able to trade either goods that they were producing or that they were, they had other reasons to commune, to use that as a verb.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, we still see that in cities, right? The agglomeration of certain industries, and they go close together, you know, certain types of manufacturing or retail. There's certain benefits of being close to another, even though it may seem like they're in direct competition. There are benefits of doing that. And I think some of the same dynamics are at play today that were before, right? It's just individual actors deciding that this is the best place for them rather than, you know, some centralized planning authority saying, okay, you should go there and you should do these type of activities. This was all led by kind of individual desires. And that's why a lot of people refer to the process of emergence. It's kind of similar of what you see in nature. For instance, a swarm of birds that grow or that fly in packs without a real leader, but nevertheless have these kind of large, seemingly coordinated shapes. So that's really fascinating that we see that same process in kind of those early cities.
That's where I want to jump in. Going back to Dan's original question here about what he wanted to debunk or prove conclusively, I'm curious where you fall on the sort of spectrum of the, to quote the Churchillian phrase, right? We shape our buildings and then they shape us. Like, it's interesting with home, like, you know, writers like Bill Bryson or I think Bachelard's Poetics of Space have tried to sort of universalize home. And then you had Pierre Bourdieu and like the idea of habitus of like that we are shaped by our domesticity, and that defines how we see the world. Where do you fall on that continuum in terms of like how universal is home, or what features, and how much do we think of that, you know, wrongly as universal?
Well, as you know, I'm originally from the Netherlands, and you know, I grew up in kind of Dutch culture, which is very different. So now, you know, my kids are growing up in America, kind of suburbia in New Jersey. So I have kind of two childhoods. And different homes, and what, you know, I lived across in from different places, from like a Hong Kong pencil tower to a walk up and a skyscraper in New York City to kind of a, you know, small studio apartment in the historic center of Barcelona and Paris. So what strikes me is that, you know, as I moved through all these different homes, my way of looking at the world evolved with it as well. So in Netherlands, for instance, as I grew up, it was a row house, relatively dense bike paths. You know, I was able to, you know, share its streets, so able to, you know, kick the soccer ball on the street, bike to school as a 5 year old. Here in American suburbia, yeah, the car culture. I'm terrified if I walk on the street with my kids, you know, no sidewalks, there's car lines where you drop off your kid to school. So it's just so fundamentally different. And what strikes me then is that when I go back to the Netherlands and visit my sister in Amsterdam, who lives in kind of this multifamily building with 100 families and the shared courtyard. And I see all the things that I once took for granted and now feel foreign to me. So I see, for instance, her, you know, her kids play on streets. I'm like, oh my God, that's so dangerous. You shouldn't do that. Or I say, hey, you know, why shouldn't you move into a kind of a bigger place? But not realizing that she kind of enjoys living so close to other people and have all these benefits of all these social relations and that more denser lifestyle brings to young families. So yeah, in other words, your house is not just kind of where you live, it's also how you live, and it shapes so many things, from your social relations to your health. You think about, you know, when you travel these days with smartwatches, you can very quickly see how many steps you do every day. the average American takes about 4,000 steps a day. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors took up to 18,000, and in many other cultures like Japan, it's much more. It's almost closer to 8,000-9,000. There's a clear relationship between daily step counts and public health, in particular cardiovascular diseases and obesity and others. So it's really shaping not just where we live, but also kind of the health of our kind of social fabric as well as our own bodies.
You know, looking at this on the public health angle, reminds me of something else too, which is, I think it's, for those who study urban history, even casually, I think we have a couple of really significant moments in mind, and a lot of them have to do with the provision of fresh water. So we think about the Roman aqueducts, and then on the other end of the equation, we think about the Victorian sewer as being very important developments. And you do address both of those in the book. But one of the things that I thought was interesting that comes up again and again in both the individual home both at the scale of the individual home and at the city scale is drainage. Like, nobody thinks about drainage when they're writing urban histories, but you managed to describe the drains of like three or four different types of buildings in three, four different eras. What got you fixated on drainage? Why is that important?
Yeah, so up until kind of the Victorian sewer, cities were essentially death traps, meaning that it took migration for cities to grow. Otherwise, they would dwindle naturally because of the attrition rate. Because cities were very dangerous places to live, and sewer was a big part of that, and all the disease that was related to kind of a lack of a modern sewer. So cities were naturally restrained by this problem, and they really needed to attract migrants to grow. And on one hand, that had to do with very dangerous conditions living close by when you don't have sewer. The other reason was kind of a lack of fertility rates as cities grew bigger, and you had kind of only a smaller kind of privileged class and others that weren't able to reproduce as much. So even cities like Rome, for instance, we talk of Rome as this great city of aqueducts, but it was also a great city of cemeteries. And if you go back to some of the accounts, you read about some people lying dead next to the road, and there's some pretty macabre accounts. And it was a very dangerous place to live. The average age or the average lifespan was in the low 20s. This was extremely dangerous, and it wasn't until that the modern sewage was invented that cities were no longer the death traps that they once were. But what's interesting is that it takes us so long to get there, and there were a lot of early efforts. I think we intuitively knew that there was something wrong. So already in Mesopotamia, you see some text about people trying to make drains, and it's quite complicated. They have these kind of different cylinders that they combine together, that they nest in each other, and they're trying to remove the water away from the house. There's also great anecdotes about kind of the Romans who initially had sewers, but then there's this story about this sewer that ended in the ocean, about this octopus that swam up the sewer into someone's home, pillaging their food.
I was waiting for you to bring that one up. If you weren't, I was going to. I don't know if do we get to alligators in New York or do we skip that one? Was that just debunked altogether? That was the wildest story. That one, and then something about an oxen getting loose and climbing stairs was another great story from there.
Yeah. So this is also, I'm really fascinated by these technologies. So like the sewer, but the other, of course, is the multifamily house and the multi-story building. When that first emerged, and it's hard to pinpoint exactly, but most historians believe that it was in Rome that you had the first multi-story buildings. And yeah, there's this one anecdote about like an ox, you know, going up, you know, several stories. But what's fascinating, what really enabled this to do this in a safe way was, of course, Roman concrete that the Romans invented that led to the Colosseum and led to the Pantheon. But from our perspective, it led to density. It led to people stacking on different stories. But even then, drainage was still a big problem. And so you read about how it was actually quite dangerous to walk next to these multi-story buildings, because sometimes people would like throw out the chamber pot outside of the window. There's lots of fascinating anecdotes about these kind of first true multi-story buildings.
Well, speaking of multi-story buildings and the multifamily, things taken for norm in the United States, right? Single families and single family homes, you know, nuclear family units there. When did the idea of a single family having a single dwelling actually emerge, and what kind of arrangements have you seen? Because it's really interesting that, you know, for example, there's a resurgence of interest in co-housing models and the idea of, at least in hyper-developed Western societies, of like having a resurgence of this. But of course, like, you know, for example, in the Indian subcontinent, I mean, intergenerational living has been a standard for some time. So I'm curious, like, where do you see these norms changing over time?
So there are several offers that point to the origin of the single family home being a kind of in 17th century Amsterdam, the canal house. And they contrast that canal house with the palazzo, for instance, in other cultures like, you know, France or Italy, that's much more communal living, where you have multiple families and, you know, large bodies of servants all living under a single roof. What's happened in 17th century Amsterdam, which, you know, at the time there was a lot of wealth that was being created, and, you know, some see it as the first kind of capitalist or proto-capitalist society, and, you know, partially it was the emergence of a new kind of upper middle class or bourgeoisie, that you know, a class of merchants that didn't really exist before, right? That were able to escape kind of the feudal or the reins of the church. They reclaimed their own land, they owned their own land. And you know, there's a great book by Russell Shorto on Amsterdam, those in New York, but they see kind of the foundation of liberalism, you know, emerge from that, and kind of this idea around the kind of individual take hold. So Dutch families, although they were wealthy, they may have only had, you know, one servant at most. So the homes were very much like we would imagine them today. You had, you know, every person had their own individual room. They had their own belongings and symbolism in each room. Of course, paintings were very important. You know, this is the era of Vermeer and a lot of kind of painting of Dutch domestic scenes. A lot of people kind of situated there. So it's pretty fascinating how that emerged and kind of set the stage for capitalism, you know, going forward, but also how we would live with the household as a fundamental unit.
Really interesting. I also note that, you know, this book pretty much does carry the sweep of civilization from, you know, 6,000 BC, 6,500 or so, near the beginning of the Neolithic period, you know, to the present day. There is quite a gap between basically the collapse of Rome and Amsterdam in the 1600s. Yeah. I mean, I think history definitely looks at the medieval period as not being great for humanity and the progress of civilization. Did you skip that purposefully, or was there something in there that did you hit a research roadblock, or how come we're not hearing about the medieval period?
Yeah, if you look at kind of settlements and size, it seems like around, you know, the civilization of Rome, but also in other cultures like Khmer, it kind of hit this peak of about a million people. And it wasn't until the kind of industrial revolution that for the first time we see that peak or that ceiling being shattered. It wasn't that there were a lot of interesting innovations in kind of medieval societies and civilizations, but I wanted to truly kind of paint an arc of what was it that kind of propelled us forward from a dwelling perspective. So what's really fascinating, of course, is that Rome kind of dwindles after the sack of Rome and never really regained its glory for centuries. But there were a lot of other very large cities that also fell, and actually they were completely abandoned, like cities like Angkor and in Cambodia, as well as a lot of those Mayan and Aztec cities that all to some extent they kind of pushed the limits of what they could become, and then they collapsed.
Yeah, and I think my own assessment of what's missing in the history, of course, is very Eurocentric. And of course, that's because the great body of literature that we have to date is predominantly Eurocentric also. But of course, there were other things happening in other parts of the world that were advancing the general character of cities. I did think your observation of Angkor Wat was interesting, because going back to our earlier discussion about monuments, the only thing that really remains of human civilization that you can see at Angkor Wat, which is why everyone goes there, is the monuments. But your point is that there was a huge gridded city that would have been recognizable in its form, albeit it sounded like everything was built with kind of plant material, right? Like reeds and that type of thing. And that was what had disappeared. What was the story of that caused Angkor Wat to collapse?
Yeah. Well, it's actually a story that connects a lot of the kind of tropical cities. So it's a story that's quite similar when you compare that to the Mayans and the Aztecs. And I'm building on the work of Roland Fletcher here, who has done some amazing work around this. But what has brought this work kind of back to our attention is new technology. So LiDAR scanning, which allows us to scan kind of underneath forest canopies, allow us to see all these broader outlines of cities that we didn't know existed before. So I've been to Angkor several times, and of course everybody goes there for the temples, and the obvious narrative is, oh, look at this society. They squandered so much on monuments, and now they are reclaimed by the jungle, right? And that's kind of the Easter Island thesis, right? So what's so fascinating, though, is that Angkor, as we've seen from those LiDAR scans, was massive. It had probably around 1 million people, the same as Rome, but it was dozens of times bigger. So it had much more of a sprawling footprint. And why did they live this way? It was kind of a function of this tropical forest condition where you can live very close to your crops. So it's a very different form of agriculture that the Romans did, which was more based on intensification of land outside of the city. This was based on extensification, where you have kind of lots of garden plots everywhere in the city. Now, what binds a lot of those cultures is that they are marked by monsoons, meaning, you have a period of heavy rain and then you have a period of droughts. So to manage that with agriculture, you need to have very large bodies of water reservoirs and canals to manage all of this. Now, the fascinating thing is that extensive canal, which was a source of strength, it also became the Achilles heel. So this massive amount of infrastructure, when there was some climatic variation, like periods of extended droughts or periods of extended rain, this led to either kind of a lack of water, or there was simply too much water. They could no longer maintain it as the temperature started to fluctuate. And of course, you know, other civilizations also suffer those kind of climatic variations, but they continue to exist. But societies like the Khmer in Angkor, eventually they could no longer kind of sustain the population. People started to move out of the city to other areas. They could not maintain the water reservoirs and all the canals. And eventually, you know, that city was abandoned. Whereas other cities like Rome, kind of the compact model, the dense model, yes, it also suffered from those climatic variations. Their crops also diminished and so on. But nevertheless, they continued to exist because it was simply more efficient for people to live there compared to this very sprawling city like Angkor.
Interesting. Well, of course, you know, in the 20th century context, you know, I think, or I should say the 21st century revisionist view of how the 20th century progressed, which was a gradual, you know, decentralization, at least in most Western societies, right? The suburbanization, we all know the story of the sprawl, the energy consumption, all this kind of stuff. It seems like you might have a general thesis about sprawl being kind of the central thing that kills cities, even in pre-industrial times. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's fair. And so it's a little bit scary when we think about that, because there are a lot of similarities. So yeah, a lot of kind of the sprawling excerpts of, you know, of some of the cities, especially in North America, they're very low density, but as a function, they rely on a lot of infrastructure that needs to be maintained, right? So if you compare like a city like Phoenix with Barcelona, right, a similar population size, but then Phoenix is you know, at least like 10 times, if not more, bigger. So if you're the mayor of that town, you have the same amount of tax resources, but suddenly you need to cover 10, 20 times more area. So now, of course, you know, the other similarity is the climatic instability. So that those societies then suffered, we're also seeing today. So the question is then, you know, will we also see kind of those sprawling areas kind of suffer more than those are compact? You know, of course, the verdict is out. What we are seeing, though, is that, you know, more and more areas are, in fact, kind of densifying, not everywhere, but, you know, some select areas. So there are definitely certain benefits of living closer together. And kind of the payment and maintenance of infrastructure is one of those benefits.
Yeah, it's interesting, this hubris narrative, because you're right, it is often concentrated on, which, you know, I'm sure this is true to an extent, but it is often concentrated on the monument building, the extension of empire, things like that. It rarely is attributed, at least in the histories that I've read or been privy to, it is rarely attributed to infrastructure management and spatial organization. Those are not as sexy topics as monument building, hubris of the, you know, the godlike ambitions of, you know, egotistical leaders and their empires, but it sounds like there's something to that, because, you know, yeah, Rome got overextended, but you're saying that the civilizational format of the city itself, if we're not talking about the Roman Empire, is actually quite resilient.
You know, that's so fascinating to me too. And, you know, of course, it's hard to point in history exactly what it was. You know, very often there was also, in the case of Angkor, there was also some political conflict. You know, there were some larger societal dynamics that also contributed to kind of the downfall of Angkor. But then what accelerates it is kind of this lifestyle. And you see that across history. So for instance, there's this Mesopotamian town that used a lot of plaster. And plaster where it wasn't really unnecessary. So plaster is great because you can kind of insulate and waterproof your floors. But there was this one particular town in which it became a status symbol, and they started to use it everywhere. But to burn this plaster, they took down a lot of trees. And you know, as they took down trees, there were more kind of floods because the roots were no longer absorbing the water. Their crops diminished, and eventually the town was abandoned. That's similar in other other stories in Mesopotamia. You see how, because of this intensification of agriculture and irrigation, the salt kind of that the soil becomes too salty, and you know, the crops diminish. And as political conflicts increase and there's increasingly kind of outside pressure, this then also contributes to the downfall. So it's never a simple story. Oh, this led to X, but it's nevertheless kind of sets the stage, and it definitely has a factor in it. And it's something that is maybe not as glamorous as, you know, this certain ruler or king that is this and that, but it's so important. I was fortunate enough to be able to geek out on these little details.
Well, I think to follow on that and to take, I'm going to make sure we spend a minute or two on the scale of the home itself, because we have been talking broadly more about urban scale and even, you know, nation scale, the proto-nation scale. So, you know, if we talk about the home, you know, let's dwell on one space that's super important in every home, the kitchen, right? There's sort of a kitchen thread that goes throughout the book too. I mean, the primordial hearth being super important to pretty much every society. Of course, you have to eat, you have to cook. To the Frankfurt kitchen, you know, which was this sort of uber efficient idea that came about in the 20s and 30s in Weimar Germany about how you could minimize the number of movements that you had to make in order to work in a small kitchen. And then, of course, you know, you think about the McMansion and the metastasized kitchen, the social kitchen, and how there was a sort of recognition of how this was where people liked together because that's where the activity was. So the kitchens themselves got bigger and bigger and bigger, and to the point that they're like showpieces that take up half the ground floor of some of these oversized houses that we have. So I guess the question is, you know, where do you see kitchens going next in the trajectory of domesticity? And what does that tell us about, I don't know, dwelling on Earth? What does it tell us about society?
That's a great question.
I'm asking this as someone who doesn't spend a lot of time in the kitchen and has a very small one that's very clean because I don't use it.
So I grew up in this small row house, and yeah, a kitchen was kind of a side room, and it's very different from the kitchens that I see in suburban America, where it, you know, the desire is for open kitchen, and you want a kitchen that is connected to the family room, and you know, you need to have certain number of appliances, a size fridge, and there needs to be kind of a breakfast nook, so a separate area for that. But the kitchen plays such a kind of fundamental role. But you know, and yes, you're right to connect it all the way to the hearth and the kind of management of fire, right? Hundreds of thousands of years ago, that really set the scene for dwelling and being able to, you know, cook food and you know, spend time together. You know, the hearth really became a place where people gathered. And there was a lot of benefits for our species to do that, because unlike other species, you know, our kids take a long time to grow up. So by pooling resources together, you know, around foods, you know, sharing food, that would kind of alleviate some of those tasks. So it kind of sets the stage for kind of dwelling and permanent settlement, even, you know, long before agriculture. Now, I have a personal anecdote, is that when I went to college, and initially that was in Delft, Netherlands, I went to architecture school. It was in this 1960s modernist housing in which the architects, they really tried to promote collectivity, and they did that through the kitchen. So there was 16 roommates, all had our kind of individual room. But then as you went into the kind of apartment, there was kitchen. You walked into the kitchen. It was really the center of everything. When you go to the bathroom, go to the shower, go to your room, you would always walk through the kitchen. And this built this kind of collectivism and this collaboration that was not mandatory. It kind of happened organically. And we started cooking for another and taking turns to do that. While I was there, one of my roommates became the town's youngest mayor. And I think that kind of speaks to that kind of culture that evolved around kind of eating and cooking. So you know, what is the future for the kitchen? I think, you know, the question is, it really kind of varies so much still, right? Those row homes with these small kitchens still exist. Those student apartments still exist. You know, the American McMansion with these, you know, vast, open, cavernous kitchens still exist. I think that the story here really is around, you know, evolution, our ideas around, you know, living together, eating together, you know, what a kitchen means for us, for our lifestyles, for what we project to others. I think that is an evolving story, and it will continue to be. And it's such a foundational thing of our dwelling experience. Yeah.
Well, being a tall building guy, I have to ask this question. Of course, your previous book was Super Talls, which looked at the phenomenon of skyscrapers. And I note that the cover of your new book, Dwelling on Earth, has about 80% tall buildings on it, or at least, you know, buildings that are predominantly vertical, including some fairly modern ones. I see Bosco Verticale there, the green planted structures in Milan. I see Mjolstarnet, which is the timber building in Brumunddal, Norway, which is pretty obscure outside of my line of work. How did you choose some of these cover images, and where does the research that you undertook for Super Talls and the conclusions you came to inform some of the work that has gone into Dwelling on Earth?
Well, of course, if you look at the large arc of dwelling, to go from, you know, a bunch of rocks, scattered rocks, to, you know, the multi-story Roman insula, to the kind of these massive super tall skyscrapers, there's a kind of clear arc of evolution there that is pretty remarkable, right? And a lot of it is about all these technologies that make that possible. The reason I selected those buildings, because I think they represent something that is very positive. Now, we started our conversation by talking about the house and its important role in our society. You know, part of that is, of course, also the role on our as individuals, but also on the planet. And of course, if you look at the amount of carbon emissions or waste as it pertains to kind of living, it's enormous. And we are responsible of that as architects. So it really strikes me as very positive that there's a lot of new developments happening in our field when architects are building with new materials like mass timber, which are much better for the environment than concrete, or they're trying to bring in greenery like Bosco Verticale. So for me, this is part of a kind of a departure from the Industrial Revolution that really focused on kind of petrochemicals and mineralized materials to a future of architecture that maybe goes back to our roots, and that's more based on bio-based materials like timber. So it's kind of this full circle that's pretty amazing. And, you know, one thing I love is, for instance, if there's this company called Icon that's doing 3D printing. They're for NASA, they developed this prototype to build on the moon. But in a way, they're doing this all with local moon dust or lunar regolith, which in a way is not too far off if you look at those old Mesopotamian cities where you had, you know, people making bricks out of local mud and putting it together. So So in a way, we've gone full circle to these more kind of localized building methods. So what they're doing on the moon will hopefully make our architecture on the Earth more sustainable as well.
Well, hopefully we don't feel compelled to migrate to the moon or other planets, as some of our some of our wealthiest citizens seem to be advocating, which isn't to say that we don't have anything to learn from that innovation. You know, even though it's 1/6 the gravity, and obviously, you know, neighbors are not a problem, so there's no zoning to worry about. You know, you build whatever you want on
the moon. Not yet.
But, you know, I use this analogy too when I try to not necessarily justify full stop the construction of skyscrapers, but I always use the analogy of the moonshot, which is, you know, we have to test the limits of technology to know what we can normalize into, you know, standard operations that can be widely distributed and reproduced. So, you know, all the innovations that came about because we went to the moon, you know, with aerospace, with technology like Velcro, and just, you know, preservatives for food, maybe that's a mixed bag of benefit, but, you know, we have to continue to innovate. And I suppose that I don't know if that's an argument for this kind of the centralized power theory of history that I think your book is pushing against a little bit, you know, kind of looking at the organic way that people have developed new ways of living by trial and error. So that's really an interesting way of categorizing it. I don't know that isn't exactly a conclusion, except that we probably need to be looking very carefully at what both centralized power and indigenous is probably not the word I want to use, but organic developments at the household level both can drive innovation. Maybe that's the conclusion.
Yeah. One thing I love is go back to those very first acts of building. And I mentioned that in the book is Colombo Falls, like 500,000 years ago. And it's literally two timbers that were joined together. And this was prior to Homo sapiens, by the way. So there's that kind of impulse of building. We don't know exactly why they built it. It may have been this platform for dwelling or something like that. But it's that building impulse that really sets us apart from other species. And the way I love describing it is using a term that's the other archaeologists use is the idea of the ultra social engineers. So yes, we are engineers. We can build things, and you know put things together, and we use tools better than other species. But there's this other aspect of us that makes us even better or supercharged engineers, is that we're ultra social, right? We use communication to talk to each other. You know, we settle together in patterns that were increasingly bigger, right? And the idea of the village, the city, you know, larger societies, now social media, of course. So we have these scalable social networks. But you put those two things together, kind of engineering and kind of this sociable aspect of our species, that really puts us on this very exciting trajectory of, you know, inventing things. Then, of course, stuff breaking down and creating lots of problems, and then us trying to solve those problems again. And there's the kind of this arc that's like that always seems to happen, right? So we create, there's one problem, we try to solve it, and then as we solve it, we just create our next problem, right? And there's that aspect to it. That's quite fascinating. So I'm confident that we will figure out some solution. I think it's part of our kind of builders DNA. But it's so interesting how we have evolved but how that kind of building impulse is so fundamental, part of who we are.
Well, that's a very optimistic read on the data that you've collected, and I'd love to go with that. So, Stefan, I want to thank you once again for joining Unfrozen. This has been Stefan Ahl talking about Dwelling on Earth, the Past and Future of the Places We Call Home, new book out. Welcome again. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Daniel. Really appreciate it. That was fun.